Massive black clouds of dust emerged on the horizon and engulfed entire communities like a black blizzard. People thought it was the end of the world. Extensive deep plowing of virgin topsoil in the Great Plains region displaced the natural grasses that normally kept the soil in place. In the 1930s, as the region saw drought and high winds, dust storms ensued, creating a decade-long period known as the Dust Bowl that affected hundreds of thousands of people. Good morning. I'm Suzanne Hogan. It's a special fundraiser edition of Central Standard on KCUR. Today, examining the pieces of art and imagery that came from that era, the stories of farmers who lived through the disaster, their tales of loss and survival, and lessons learned as we examine the greatest environmental man-made natural disaster in America. Stay with us for Central Standard just after this hour's news. In 1931, when the rain stopped and the winds picked up, all the broken up topsoil that had been plowed and previously a paradise for wheat farmers became a desolate desert for a decade. Many thought it was the end of the world. Black blankets of dust pummeled the South Plains, taking the lives of many and displacing hundreds and thousands. Good morning. Thanks for listening, and welcome to a fundraiser edition of Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Throughout the hour, we'll be asking you for you to call in and support KCUR. You can make a pledge by calling 816-235-5287 or go online at kcur.org. But the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence has two exhibits exploring art from about the Dust Bowl. One Kansas Farmer and Dust. Our guest this morning, Kate Meyer, is the curator for the Dust exhibit. She's joining us from the studios at KPR in Lawrence. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
It's so nice for you to join us this morning. So you're giving a lecture Wednesday at the Spencer Museum at 5:30. What's going on with that lecture?
I am going to try to talk about the way that images reveal the history of our engagement with the landscape through agriculture, and how that that relationship really became broken during the 1930s. How you can see it coming through the story that images tell.
So let's talk a little bit about this story and get some historical context here. What was going on in the South Plains region in the early 1900s? Who was immigrating to that area? Kate, are you with us? It looks like we've lost Kate.
I'm here.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I was asking, what was going on in the early 1900s in Kansas and the South Plains area, and who was coming to that area, coming to that region?
Well, it's the last big land grab down in parts of the Oklahoma Panhandle. And you see farmers who are, well, in Kansas, we're the free state for a reason, that you see people coming to try to have land to own and land to farm. And it was land that had previously been a grassland, and then slightly before that it had been grazing lands, land that was not necessarily well suited to being plowed up and farmed in the way that they did. But at first, when the rains were good, the getting was great.
And there were great efforts to attract farmers during that time, and a lot of really amazing images from that time as well. Can you talk about some of those?
One of my favorite images, well, you can go back to sort of early iconography. Even the seal of my state of Kansas has a little farmer with a single plow plowing up the landscape, and early kinds of booster images of American progress, this personification of progress, galloping over the countryside, laying telegraph line with farmers in her wake, that the country was made for us, ready to be civilized, domesticated, and changed.
And there were ads of giant watermelons, huge cucumbers. Really, they were trying to appeal to farmers that you could really make a living here.
Absolutely. Think about some of the names of even little towns, and Garden City is not a little one. But I love the idea of naming a Western Kansas town Garden City.
So what were some of the dreams of these farmers, particularly in Kansas during this time?
Well, I don't know that that's different from anyone's dream anywhere at any time. You want to have land that you own. You want to succeed. You want to be able to provide for your family.
And in 1931, a kind of toxic combination of things happened. Can you describe some of these first dust storms and what happened here in 1931 when the rain stopped?
Sure. If you think about what grass is like, and here I'm not thinking of the grass that you grow in your lawn. I'm thinking of prairie grasses. These grasses have long, thick, dense root systems that hold the soil in place throughout the year, even in dry years, and there were many. And if you were to plow up those grasses and then plant an annual crop like wheat or corn in its place, and perhaps you have a hot, dry year, then that crop will fail. And the root system of an annual plant is much smaller, it doesn't spread as much throughout the soil, and there would be nothing to hold the soil in place. And you see, particularly during World War I, what we call now the Great Plow Up, and tremendous percentages of the grasslands had been converted into cropland. And when you see a region prone to aridity, having incredibly hot, dry spells, there was nothing to tether the soil, and it rose up in protest.
And some of those first dust storms really terrified farmers. Can you describe what some of those storms looked like?
Sure. We have a great print in the exhibition of an artist thinking back in 1938 to 1935, to Black Sunday, which is described as one of the worst, if not the worst, dust storm. And it looked sort of like a mountain on the horizon, a dark cloud thundering toward you. And when it would hit, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. You couldn't see a light. You would maybe need to tie up a rope to be able to get from your house to the barn or to try to find your way back from school. And it would, the dust came everywhere, became everything, and it would choke the life out of you.
And there were some great health hazards, too, as well, that people suffered from dust pneumonia, kids were dying and not able to breathe. What were some of the other health side effects that people were living with during that time?
Well, apparently, there was a tremendous amount of static electricity from the dust rolling in. And the static, you wouldn't want to shake hands with someone. And the static would knock out your car and could, kind of electrocute the plants that might still be alive. It's just tremendously frightening.
Yeah, and so a lot of people thought this was the end of the world. And were they right to think so in some ways?
Well, it was the end of a certain pattern of existence. The way that we farmed after the Dust Bowl was different than the way we had before. And I think now when we look back on the Dust Bowl, we recognize it as a very cautionary tale about humans' relationship with their land. So for me, much after the fact, it is the end. It represents the end of certain ways of thinking, and yet an incredible reminder for today and for the future.
Yes, this was the biggest man-made natural disaster, and we're going to get into that more because a lot of the farmers didn't realize the role that they had in creating this disaster.
Lots of folks back east this say is leaving home every day and beating a hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, trying to get out of the old dust bowl. They think they're going to a sugar bowl, but here's what they find. The police at the port of entry say, You're number 15,000 for today. Oh, if you ain't.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. I'm talking with curator Kate Meyer of the Spencer Art of Museum. She's researched extensively the art from and about the Dust Bowl. She's giving a talk Wednesday evening at 5:30 at the Spencer. More information at kcur.org. Kate, so earlier we were talking about this man-made environmental disaster known as the Dust Bowl, but a lot of farmers didn't realize how much of a role they were playing in creating this problem. Can you talk about some of the educational efforts that were embarked on to educate farmers?
Sure. And not just educate the farmers, I think educate the whole nation. One of my favorites is a film that we're showing on the loop in the gallery, which is called The Plow That Broke the Plains. It's from 1936, and it's really the first government-sponsored documentary. And Per Lawrence was the writer and director of that film, and he was aided greatly by a Kansas City native named Virgil Thompson. And together they attempted to reveal how the heck we got into such a mess through telling a story of the High Plains, of the Dust Bowl region, transitioning from grasslands to wheatlands, and the peril of such an action in a very arid region. And this film utilizes a combination of really potent and powerful visual metaphors and familiar musical themes to tell a story of the people and of a place and the things that happened to them and the trouble that they were now in and the trouble that they and we all helped cause. We opened with a Woody Guthrie song, and I've been thinking lately about Guthrie, and perhaps to me, his most famous song, This Land Is Your Land. And that song ends, this land was made for you and me. And I think that kind of initial concept, that kind of foundation that the land is made for us to do with what we will, is very problematic. And We're beginning to understand that now, and we really had to confront it in the 1930s.
And The Plow That Broke the Plains, that was, for a lot of people, the first film moving image that they had ever seen, and it was really profound. But then other images that are part of the exhibit really do tell so much. There was the government hired photographers to go out and document the lives of Americans during this time. Can you talk about that program, the intention behind that?
Absolutely. Isn't that a novel idea, the government hiring photographers and putting them to work? You think about New Deal legislation under Roosevelt. You think about the Works Progress Administration. You think about the Federal Art Project. Artists were also being hired to do work, to put the country to work. And I think my favorite element of that was a project called the Farm Security Administration, the FSA. And there's a division within the FSA called the Information Division. And this was headed up by a guy from Great Bend, Kansas, named Roy Stryker. And he'd been trained as an economist out of Columbia. And Stryker realized that utilizing documentary photographs would be an incredible tool in his arsenal to raise awareness about problems and about the power of New Deal programs to help the afflicted. And so he hired some great names in photography, Walker Evans, Dorothea Lange, Arthur Rothstein. And we have a number of these photographs in the exhibition. It's a small exhibition at the museum, but I'm pleased and proud that the objects that we have in it are really primary sources to tell us this this story of these people and these places.
Yeah, one of the telling characteristics of a lot of these images is the portraiture and the quality. You can see the face and eyes and despair of these people. And you've done a lot of research on this. Can you kind of give us a sense of what people's lives were day to day and what they were going through and how that's portrayed through these images and portrait work?
Sure. we have a combination of some photographs that reveal what dust storms were like. And then sort of the next phase of that is that you see people on the move, a tremendous amount of people left the Dust Bowl region. It's an exodus of not just the soil, but of its citizens. And at the same time, it wasn't just people from Okies from Oklahoma who were leaving. There were tenant farmers from the South who were leaving as well. It's a time where we realized a number of our agricultural practices, our human relationships with the land were fraught. And so you see this great human migration moving west, and the photographers involved with the Farm Security Administration captured that in amazing ways. And you see cars on the side of the road, families who are camping there because they know there's nothing left for them where they are. The farm where they worked was foreclosed, or they were tenant farmers in the first place and they couldn't pay up the rent that they owed. And they travel west because they've heard there's hope in California or in Washington, but they're also beginning to hear that there isn't work for the Okies, that they are all getting a bad name, and they don't, Californians don't want them anymore. And we do have some really interesting photographs showing that in the exhibition.
And there were a lot of people that decided to stay, the Last Man's Club, and people who are still very proud and just hopeful that things would turn around. What was life like for the people who decided to stay in the area? How did they survive?
I think it was tough. You hear that although the big crops were failing, you could have a garden and you could subsist a little bit on what you could grow for yourself, which is a very different scale of production. People had a little bit of livestock, but also people were really relying on government aid. Some of that early New Deal legislation, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, we think of it today as the first farm bill. And that kind of aid made a big difference, a life or death difference in many circumstances.
Our guest is Kate Meyer of the Spencer Museum of Art. We're talking about the lasting memory of the Dust Bowl, lessons learned.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and a cold out heaven. Well, the price is up and the rain come down, and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money, bought clothes and groceries, fed the kids and raised the family. The rain, it quit and the wind got high, and a black old dust storm filled the sky. And I swapped my farm for a Ford machine, and I poured it full of this gas Eileen, and I started
Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Blues. I'm Suzanne Hogan. This is Central Standard. Our guest today is Kate Meyer. She's a curator at the Spencer Museum of Art. She curated the exhibit Dust on display now through the end of December and is giving a talk Wednesday night at 5:30 at the Spencer. Kate, thanks again for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So you wrote your dissertation on this topic and started out with the quote, these marvelous machines, do we shape them or do they shape us or reshape us from our descent, far designs, Russell Lord. Why did you start with that quote, and what's the significance of that to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, Russell Lord's another one of those Columbia-trained economists, and yet he used his voice to talk about problems in society in really accessible ways. And here I think he's talking about the impact of machines upon the landscape. And previously we mentioned a film we're showing in the exhibition, The Plow That Broke the Plains. And the plow gets quite a bad rap for being the instrument through which so much change was wrecked upon the landscape. But by the late 1930s and into the 40s, it's not just one of those single blade plows. It's the tractor, and the amount of land a single person could plow in a day just ratchets up through this time period through the aid of technology, through the aid of machinery. And so the mark that we make upon the land, its impact just increased dramatically with that technology. And I believe it's either Dorothea Lange or John Steinbeck talking about tractors, that they drive the land and they drive us off the land. The tractor enabled one operator to plow up a field, and there wouldn't be as many need for farmers to work the land. And it was an instrument that radically transformed technology. You think about the idea of there's a great writer in American studies, Leo Marx. He talks about the machine in the garden, the confrontation of technology in what we think of as the pastoral. And he's really thinking about trains at that moment, but gosh, it works so well for the plow and the tractor and its impact on the grasslands as well.
So what has sparked your interest in this topic? You've clearly researched it a lot and spent a lot of time and interest in with the images that came from this time. Are you from this region, and does it have a historical and deeper significance to you personally?
I think so. My hometown's Leavenworth, and I grew up there, but most of my family is actually out from Riley County, out by Manhattan. And, you know, go back four or five generations, my folks were Kansans, and many of them began as farmers. My paternal grandparents grew up on farms out in Riley County in the 30s and 40s. They didn't end up farming themselves, but I consider myself to be a very rooted person. I care about this place, and I'm interested in its history and its future. And you know, I'm trying to sort of bloom where I'm planted. And I think for all of those reasons, I'm fascinated by a moment that's marked by its rootlessness. Mm. The plow up, creating a change in the way the soil of the place, of the heartland, was held. And when the heartland was imperiled, it drew quite a bit of attention, both for, I think, sentimental reasons and because of just the sheer scope of the atrocity. And I feel, I suppose, compelled to try to make people more aware of this aspect of history, and yet my training and interest is through works of art, through images, and I think they tell a tremendous story. And being able to tease out conversations about how we feel and have felt about our place through images is a powerful way to do things.
And stories and memories of survivors of this time are becoming harder to find. What kind of work have you been doing through interviews to talk to people who lived through this?
Sure. In, I guess it was 2009, I did a speaking tour with the Kansas Humanities Council to promote a program that was called Picturing America, doing just what I was speaking about, using images to talk about people and history and place. And so I was talking about the Dust Bowl, and I would have these little speaking engagements all over the state, including out in Elkhart, which is right by the southwest corner of Kansas, the heart of Dust Bowl country. And I don't know about your experience, but when you do when you give a talk at a public library or a county historical society, it tends to draw more octogenarians than you might suspect. And I was able to meet a surprising number of wonderful people who remembered their childhoods during the Dirty 30s. And that was amazing. I couldn't have asked for a better opportunity to do field work with the people who remember. And memory is a precious and fleeting resource.
And not just people were affected. It had greater environmental effects. Grasshoppers, waves of grasshoppers and jackrabbits coming through, cattle being slaughtered. So many crazy visual elements going on there that were documented as well, and memories that are still being told today. Still to come, lessons learned from the Dust Bowl. Could it happen again?
I'm a Dust Bowl refugee, just a Dust Bowl refugee. From that Dust Bowl to the Peach Bowl, now that peach fuzz is killing me.
This is Central Standard on KCUR. We hope today's conversation will inspire some pledges of support. Thanks for listening. Our guest, Kate Meyer, is giving a talk Wednesday night at the Spencer Museum of Art in Lawrence. She's a curator there. They're showing two exhibits exploring themes of the Dust Bowl, One Kansas Farmer and Dust. Thanks again, Kate, for being with us.
I'm happy to do it.
So nearly a decade of drought in the Southern Plains region. Hugh Bennett was a character, a soil conservationist, that played a pretty big role in making it so that when the rains did come back, Kansas and the area surrounding it was able to recover. Can you talk about Hugh Bennett?
Oh, Hugh Bennett's the best. Hugh Bennett, I think, strove to convince Washington that we needed a soil conservation service. He was testifying before, I think, Congress, and had heard that these dust storms, they didn't just stay in the Dust Bowl. They kept moving. The storms sometimes would travel all the way to the eastern seaboard, and he's sort of stalling because he's waiting for the word that the Dust Bowl is actually going to come by Washington. And when it does, he points up to the sky and said, "There goes Oklahoma." And they create the soil conservation service.
Well, so this was the first time that people in the east side of the country kind of understood what everybody else had been going through in this region, right?
Sure. I think that it's a persuasive tactic. Those dust storms made people realize, oh, my God, something is up. And actually, Per Lawrence, who does Plow That Broke the Plains, he was really inspired by seeing dust overhead in Times Square just a few years earlier. So it was an interesting ambassador, if you will, the dust itself. And Bennett recognized that it wasn't just the Dust Bowl region where we had a problem. A tremendous amount of the country was suffering from agricultural erosion. And in the Dust Bowl, it's erosion by wind, but across the country, you also see erosion by water. And Bennett worked with agricultural departments, agronomists, county extension agents, working on ways to manage the land differently and try to develop practices and techniques that would hold the soil in place more successfully. And we see a number of those practices still in use, although sometimes I think they're threatened because once again you see the price of commodities going so high that it's very tempting to want to tear up your shelter belt or some of the other soil erosion practices that he advocated for.
But here in Kansas, I mean, when the rains came, it was able to hold on to the soil better, and that's because of efforts to create protected grasslands. Is that right? And what other efforts?
That's true. Well, if you, let's see, there's contour plowing. If you plow across a slope rather than directly down it, you're going to create some more resistance to the water to hold it in place better. If you can create terraces, you can plant crops in strips so that you're getting some more variety. You can plant shelter belts. And in a lot of areas of the Dust Bowl itself, you also see emergence of preserved areas of grasslands, Cimarron National Grasslands out in Morton County, and it's just gorgeous. But it is a place where efforts were made to try to return the landscape to its original grassland ecosystem because those perennial plants hold the soil much better than our other systems.
Just one final question. Do you believe that the Dust Bowl could happen again? And what do you think is the role of exhibits like the one at the Spencer and the research that you're doing in preventing that from possibly happening?
Well, the One Kansas Farmer project is a poster, a panel project where I ask design students to try to learn from the way we understand the Dust Bowl. It's very interdisciplinary, memories, images, facts, and turn that lens to what's going on with farming today. Could the Dust Bowl happen again? Could it happen in the future? Drawing upon current NSF research that's happening at the University of Kansas and Kansas State, trying to understand farmers. And I think the answer is that our relationship with the environment remains tenuous, and we've added new variables to the equation with irrigation, and we need to pay attention. And I hope that exhibits help draw attention to the past and to the future.
That's Kate Meyer. She's a curator at the Spencer Museum of Art, where they're showing two exhibits exploring the Dust Bowl, One Kansas Farmer and Dust. Kate, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.